I want to sort of change topics altogether, sort of, and ask you a question about the Iraq War. And there's British and Scottish soldiers serving in Iraq right now. And I was wondering, like, in the United States and in Canada, we have groups like StopWar.ca, and there's groups in the United States that are fighting against the war. And I was wondering if in Britain and Scotland, and if the Scottish Parliament or the party, your Scottish, the Socialist Party, are also fighting against the British involvement in the Iraq War.
Absolutely. And okay, that's a whole discussion in itself, but that's another reason why it's been good that we've been in the Parliament in the last year, because we've forced debates in Iraq as well, and we've forced them to declare their hand on Iraq, and we've had protests in the public gallery about the war as well, but we've also been involved on the streets in road blockades and everything. It's quite funny, I've got two teenage daughters and they were involved in all the anti-war protests as well. And the irony being that it was really, really hot for a period of time, and there was weekday protests as well as weekend protests, and there were quite a few days where the whole of Glasgow city centre was brought to a halt by road blockades, a protest. So my two teenage daughters were involved in that, and me and my friend, particularly my friend Rosie, she's got two teenage daughters as well, she's in the Parliament too, we were like throwing our children in front of buses with us, mind you. We weren't putting them out front, you know, to sit down and block the roads. And they were very enthusiastically participating. But this one night where we'd been doing that and we'd been running about the city centre and running in front of buses and grinding them a halt, and then moving on, we were like the shock troops, you know, because you had to have people who were either really, really brave or really, really stupid to do the first bit of getting the traffic to stop, and then lots of people would pile in behind you and sit down. So that was that road sealed. Then we would go to another road, get that, more people piling in. But after we didn't do it forever. Usually by kind of 9 o'clock or something, protests would settle down. And after this particular night, the protests had settled down, we were trying to go and get something to eat somewhere. And we went to cross the road, and one of my daughters went to walk out. She says, no, wait, hang on a wee minute, the Green Man's not here yet. I'm like, bit of irony there. So it's been a massive movement. I was at the demo. I actually, which one was it, Kat? I've spoke at two big demos in London. I don't know if I spoke at this one, but I was on the big 2 million one. Absolutely massive, massive. And there was big demos in Glasgow as well, and in Edinburgh, and in a lot of small towns across the whole of Scotland. And I think it was amazing to feel that power that was there. It's just possible if people will use it. And some people have said that, you know, the numbers aren't there just now. But I don't see that as a negative thing, because what people have learned through that process, they won't lose. It's experience that they will be banking for. I think what happened was that there was a lot of people mobilised into political action who'd never been involved before, who actually probably thought that their involvement in such a massive movement would actually stop the war. And it was a learning process for them that it didn't. And once the war had started, I think that they, rather than suddenly being for the war, there was a whole process in their heads of developing a wee bit of healthy cynicism towards governments. And I think that's really what's happened. But those people will mobilise again. And they won't forget what has happened.
No, amidst the news that they caught an Israeli, or suspect there's an Israeli spy in the Pentagon, laughable, because if you look at this, and according to the U.S. Patriot Act, they don't even have to let Canada know that they've asked for access to their medical records, which is really, you know, that's espionage on a gigantic scale. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they put out stories that I think are just meant to distract us from what the real issues are.
Yeah. But in a more point, there are more of us than there are of them. And when people get a notion of that strength, when people do act collectively and in numbers, they can be enormously powerful, and they can win. It can sometimes quite difficult to achieve that unity of action and that solidarity and the determination. But that's what we really need to try and achieve everywhere we are. And it's not like we're succeeding in Scotland. We've made a bit of progress in terms of forming the basis of a force, hopefully, that might be able to challenge the prevailing order of things. But we've got a hell of a long way to go.
You get pepper sprayed. I mean, that's just a constant. You're not even doing anything political, but now you're being, you know, dragged to the streets because, you know, like, I just find that some of the reactions that we're getting from our police force and from our newspapers and that underlying fear that people have that if they speak out that they're going to be penalized and they're going to lose and they'd rather, like, hang on to what they've got than to risk it all and win more. I just... Mm-hmm. How do you counter that?
It's
so
big. I wish I could, you know, like, because then it would happen, but it doesn't work like that, really. But certainly, I can only speak from my experience and offer a wee bit of hope, actually, because the people who were involved in the strikes that we were involved in were nothing special. They didn't consciously plan to be involved in the sort of struggles that they were involved in. There are processes at work all of the time, and the key thing, particularly I'm thinking about the Sodexo workforce here was the most vulnerable, demoralised, quite disorganised, weak, cynical workforce who the unions had left and just ignored, really. Who were dealing with quite brutal employers. I mean, Sodexo apply all the anti-union busting techniques that, you know, best of the American schools. They isolate women on their own and back shifts, you know, when they're only working in a ward on their own. You know, they'll send the supervisor to talk to them and, you better watch yourself and all that sort of stuff. So this wasn't the easiest workforce to organise. But over a period of time, by demonstrating that you were actually willing to take up their issues, they won't get involved in something that's overtly political at that point. They know they'll not get involved in... They wouldn't have struck for a general principle of public services. They wouldn't have struck in relation to, like, an international issue. They wouldn't have... But if you are organising around an issue that is real to them in their everyday job, and they understand that you will actually see it through, if they see you dealing with the kind of grievances and stuff like that, because a lot of that, the union wasn't perfect at, because it lost its kind of activist base and everything. So unions actually, it developed quite a bad reputation for not phoning people back, not getting back to them, no following through. So it was there was a period of time where we had to turn that around and prove that we were a wee bit different, and that we would phone them back, and that we would be there when we said we would be there, that we would represent people in grievances. And we started getting a reputation. So then people were more likely to trust us, and they were more likely to take kind of advice from us. And then when we mounted a pay claim, and again, it works different, bargaining and all that works differently, because, you know, the closed shop and everything was all abolished under Thatcher. So we were staking a claim within those contracts. And you start working for it, and you're doing a bit of media stuff and all of that. And we'd had a reputation from the previous a medical secretary strike, so we developed that reputation that we were going to see things through. And it, so over a period of time, they got a bit of trust, and you can find that people who are very much like that, saying those sort of things, changing very, very quickly in the heat of a struggle. During our medical secretary strike, we had women who were they were really lowly paid, but traditionally quite a lot of the women who were medical secretaries had, some of them were like married to doctors, and you know, they had partners with decent incomes. They sort of shopped in Marks and Spencers for their lunch and things like that. They were very, you know, they saw themselves as being quite professional sort of women, and a lot of them just wouldn't ever have contemplated being in a picket line. But through the process of their discontent with their situation and their belief that they were worth more, it had started off being that strike had started off with them, it being about them as individuals deserving greater status and deserving greater pay, to it becoming about, you know, the group. It was about the struggle, as it was about collectivism, and the whole motivation for it changed in the course of the strike. And women who had previously been going to Marks and Spencers to get their tea in for the night and running home and getting the tea on the table for their husband and the family and all the rest of it, like, stuff it, they can make it themselves, you know, and they were then converted into raising all the money for hardship to keep the strike going. You know, they were on the picket lines in the morning, you know, they moved from wearing the skirts and the twin sets and all that to running about in jeans and their hair's all ragged and all of that, and they turned into really feisty women. But the best thing was seeing a lot of the women involved in the Sodexo strike, poorest paid, maybe juggling two jobs, and maybe, you know, single parents or those with no very supportive partners, some of them in abusive relationships, getting confidence and getting empowered and changing within a couple of minutes. I had photographs I was showing at the Teachers Federation conference of some of the stuff happened in the Sodexo strike, and there's a bit of a melee with the police, and there's one woman in the middle of it, and she's writing and about the chief inspector police guy, really confronting them. And she was a woman who had been quite timid and everything beforehand, and it was just like, I can't afford to get involved in this. There isn't any point anyway. People won't support us. And literally, like, 2 days later, she's gone. And she just changed like that, you know, and nothing would have got her back to work but victory. And so don't underestimate the potential for people to gain that confidence and to change, because it can happen really, really, really quickly.
One piece of it that I forgot to ask when I was doing your thing was around the percentage of the female voting population that actually votes, that exercises their vote. Do you know what that would be for?
It's different for different constituencies. It's lower than it is for men. And it's lowest in the poorest areas. Some of the elections in Glasgow, which has got the 4 poorest constituencies in Britain, the turnouts amongst women and men are around 20-25%. It's really, really shocking. And that's women, I think it's about 20%. That's a big challenge for us, because those people aren't I hate it when you hear in the television I'm talking about apathy. It's not apathy. It's well-learned cynicism. It's because they're not stupid. They've seen politicians getting in year after year after year, and their lives have got worse or certainly not improved. So they don't have any they don't have any faith in the political system. And that's a challenge for us, is getting people like that. Same process as we tried to go through in our trade union branch. Bit of confidence, no, we are different. We do follow through. We do mean what we say. What we use those parliamentary positions, the way that we use them, is absolutely crucial. And that's why the nursery strike was so important for us, you know. And the other thing is, our party's constitution requires us to live in the average skilled worker's wage. So we the rest of the money goes to the party, to helping the party. So we are living in half of the wage of the other members of the parliament. And that's one way of showing that we're not going to just go away and disappear into the ether and the lifestyle of the other politicians.
Well, I just
wanted
to ask, Sodexo, because they're here, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of contracts are they getting here? Because I've seen them in the gig. Are they in healthcare?
Yeah.
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 And I just finished my.
And they've got the. I was at the Teachers Federation Summer Conference. Was at SFU. They've got the contract up there for janitorial services, and they've subcontracted the catering to Compass.
Compass is another one.
Yeah.
And they're hiring social workers here. They're doing a lot of recruiting from Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
You know anything about that?
There's a shortage of social workers in Scotland, and an outstanding pay issue. Social work in Scotland is reaching real crisis point. Crisis is an overused word, but it is. So services like child protection and all of that are really, really struggling to cope. It's interesting you're seeing people are coming here. That'll explain why.
Well, why I've released. Yeah. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they've obviously realised that it's. A possible source.
Yeah. And I was wondering, like, is that because it's gone to such a bad state of affairs?
They're really overworked and stressed. They're running with a lot of vacancies and people are covering far too many jobs.
Okay, Sam.
My question, though, is SNP, the number of seats that you have from the Socialist Party is 6, I believe, mm-hmm. Correct? We recently went through a federal government election, and the Public Service Alliance of Canada, I think this is one of the first times that we started to become a little bit political. We actually said a few things openly to our members about voting and what they should really be thinking about when they put their name, you know, march on that ballot, as to what party was going to be best for them as basically the employer. And so I'm wondering, we have, of course, a minority with our Socialist Party in the federal government, as not quite as bad as yours, but I mean, thank God you're there. But how did your members of parliament, how did the Socialist Party talk to the union grassroots members, or how did the unions talk to their members to encourage them to vote in a socialist manner?
Certainly not at the highest level. It's all been by example. I would encourage trade union members to ask questions about what policies there actually are to make their lives better, what they actually intend to do about privatisation, about public sector wage levels, what is their programme. But in terms of what we did, again, it was actually by experience, because people's experience of your party on a day-to-day basis, we're not just about fighting elections, and we don't come out of the woodwork and, you know, launch a whole sway the material. We don't have the resources for that, saying vote for us. Every single day we're involved in political activity. We're on picket lines, we're in community campaigns, we're trying to get involved in community councils. We spend far, far more time in communities and involved in trade union support, solidarity work, than we do actually physically in the parliament. So that example spreads, and hopefully it'll spread even more, because if you were to look at our vote amongst firefighters or nursery nurses, for example, it'd be much, much higher in proportion to the vote in the rest of the population, because that's been their experience. And that's worth a hell of a lot more than a $2 million advert or, you know, media campaign. So that's our emphasis. It's about living experience, it's about practicalities, it's about judging people by their action and what they actually do, and not with the spin. And that's what we want to be judged by. And we wish that other parties were judged more clearly by that as well.
Yeah, right on. Shane, you're next on the list.
I wanted to go back to what Wanda asked, was a question on the media. In Canada, and I'm pretty sure the BBC is just as bad. The corporatization of the media is making it impossible to get leftist opinions out into the public, and I was wondering how you battle that in your situation.
Partly about experience and distributing our own literature. We can't possibly... The day that we rely on the media to get our message across is a slippery slope, and the day that we are going to end up defunct. That doesn't mean to say we don't. We use every opportunity we can get with the media. And hopefully we're getting a wee bit more savvy. And sometimes we complain a lot. We complain about if we think there's been unfair coverage, or we've been misrepresented, or so we harry some people. But again, it's maybe a wee bit more of a fertile situation in Scotland than it is here, because the National Union of Journalists and the Scottish section, their executive are very sympathetic towards the SSP, although they maintain an apolitical stance. They've never had a political funder or anything like that. So there are journalists working in Scotland in various media who are sympathetic to us. That doesn't always transfer to the editorial decisions, but they generally try and represent us in a fair way. So we use the opportunities that we get. We do, you know, again, having the parliamentary positions means it's more difficult for them to completely ignore us. But most of what I suppose the impact that we have is gained through people's direct experience of what we do in their lives, and that's the essential difference, because we're visible in their lives. We've got, you know, branches and activists and communities up and down the country, not as many as we would like, and we're building that all the time, but people should be able to see what we're doing every day, and that's the biggest influence that we can have. But we use all of these things. We've even been known to demonstrate outside media corporations and things like that if it's been necessary. Getting your own propaganda out there, if you've got resources to do that, rather than relying on it being interpreted by the general media, is very, very useful.
When you're talking about the trade union response to the Thatcher government, also the trade union response now to the Labour government, it did remind me somewhat of what's happening in BC, because we're actually experiencing a very aggressive attack from the Liberal government. You know, it's being played out on workers and poor people, etc. And I don't see the coordination and solidarity in the labour movement that I think we really need. And instead, there are some unions, I guess their tactic is, or strategy is, to try and accommodate the government or not get into a dispute with the government and encumber their demands accordingly. And then you have unions like the HEU. You know, there was a discussion about having broader walkouts. In fact, there was a, you know, interestingly enough, we'd see in the media that, the teachers and I think QB were walking out on day one, and then PSAC and GE were walking out on day two. And of course, you know, we would see this in, you know, we'd believe it, right? And we'd think there was something that was being organized, but unfortunately, it was more of a leak to make it appear that there was some coordination, solidarity, but it wasn't really being organized. And so we didn't actually do that. There was an agreement. You know, I think the rug was pulled a bit on HEU, but I think we actually missed a really big opportunity because, and I've experienced this also in the past, and I'm not just saying at the high levels of labor, but you know, I think that when you ask members to do something, they're always there, and sometimes there isn't the confidence at the leadership level sometimes in the members.
Yeah.
And because when I talk to members from different unions after the agreement that HEU ended up with, they said, you know, yeah, we were very supportive, you know, and we would have you know, there was interest in mm-hmm. joining in, mm-hmm. and so I don't know if you have any comment, but it's just, it's too bad because...
I think that there is historical parallels. I think that that's quite... It's quite obvious that there are historical parallels between what's happened in Britain and what's kind of unfolding here. And what I was at the BC Fed convention last November, and I spoke at three workshops, and there was a big discussion about mobilising and organising for a general strike. And I have to say that it amazed me that that was even being seriously discussed and considered, no matter how the vote went in the end up, because quite honestly, the trade union movement at that level, you know, like the TUC and the STUC in Britain, is so heavily bureaucratised that a discussion like that just wouldn't even get onto the conference floor. Hence, the any of the militancy that's had to come for the trade union movement in Britain has had to come through the bottom. So it's had to come from the bottom, and it's had to organise upwards. All I know is that since I've arrived here, I've met quite a lot of angry people, and I spoke to a lot of teachers who were organised over the weekend. They were organised. They were not turning up for their work on the Monday morning, and they just couldn't understand it. And it's always difficult to kind of express an opinion when you're an outsider and you're coming from another country, and so it's no for me to pass judgment or anything like that. What I would say is that I don't think that it's ever appropriate for a movement, which is clear. I mean, I was hearing that there were ice cream vans who changed their chimes into militant trade union tunes, and so there was obviously a really broad community involvement, and people were up for it, and they were prepared to challenge the government. And I don't think it is anybody's right to take the rug from under that movement without any reference to that movement. And I think the essential thing is democracy. And that's the thing that it's about members having control. It's about members having control over their organisations and setting the strategy and being consulted and their will being implemented. And the structures of big organisations, like I spoke about my union, Unison, big union, 1.5 million members. Essentially, on paper, it's got quite a democratic constitution of how it operates, member-led union and all of that. It doesn't necessarily work out like that all of the time, because there's a lot of ways that things can be kind of undermined. But in a situation like that, I would like to think, certainly the vast majority of the time, members would be, if there was an offer made, if there was a dispute and there was an offer made, then the members would be asked whether that offer was acceptable or not before any decision was taken to postpone action or anything like that. And that's, for me, the way it should be. It doesn't always necessarily happen like that. And I know I've heard different perspectives about what happened with HEU and stuff like that. And I do think that one of the arguments I've heard in support of what happened has been that the concentration should be in the election next year and getting the Liberals out, and that somehow this movement and this big challenge to the Liberal government would undermine that. Now, I don't get that. I just do not get that at all. Surely it could only have helped. So I suppose I would just kind of reference back to some of the sequence of events I was describing earlier about trade union movement's response to the miners and all of that. And unfortunately, I think some of the mistakes have been repeated. I'm trying really hard not to say. Not to be too judgmental, but that's kind of the impression that I get. And I'm not saying anything out of turn, because these principles apply wherever you are in the world. It's democracy. It's democracy. It's about people having control over their organisation, from the bottom up rather than top down, whatever that organisation is.
So I'd like to thank you very much, Caroline.
Thank you.
You're great.
Thanks.
It was great. So thank you very much for coming up.
Thanks, Caroline.